This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Forever Dog.
Hello, beautiful listeners inside and out. It's Janie Stoller, host of Relatively Healthy here, and just want to remind you dreams do come true because today I am talking with a plastic surgeon. Yes, if you've ever met me, you know that this is the one thing in life I care about is plastic surgery, but no one will ever talk with me about it and no one is willing to hear my thoughts. So luckily we have an expert on the show today and she's the best. Her name is Dr. Tina Ho. She's a facial plastic and reconstructive surgeon based in Philadelphia. I'm so excited to have her on because I have a list of 75,000 questions about facial plastic surgery and she is game to answer them. So I really hope you like this and I really hope that you will tell me what you think afterwards because basically I just need to be talking about plastic surgery all the time and hearing about it. And so, yeah, let's just do it. Okay, I am joined right now by Dr. Tina Ho. Tina, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Janie.
This is awesome. So let's dive right in. We have so many awesome questions to ask you, and it's just such a pleasure to have you. So first of all, being a plastic surgeon, that must be such an interesting job. What drew you to that specialty and particularly the facial focus?
So I think it stemmed all the way from the beginning with my own childhood surgeries. I myself was born with what we call a congenital nevus, a large mole on my forehead that, if not removed, could have a potential to develop cancer later on. So I actually myself underwent a number of reconstructive surgeries and had surgeons who took great care of me and really had a positive impact on me. I think later in medical school, what drew me first to the field of ear, nose, and throat, and then eventually facial plastic surgery was actually my particular interest in the field, as well as how this type of practice suits my own personal attributes. Within the realm of ENT, you have this focus in the head and neck region. The anatomy is really intricate, detailed. And as a plastic surgeon, I get to be very detail-oriented myself, provide decisive treatments for my patients where I see an immediate effect. And also, I found a lot of mentors in my field who had a great sense of work-life balance and that I was drawn to personality-wise that I felt like overall a lot of these reasons, made facial plastic surgery the fit for me.
Yeah. And is it not the most competitive residency to get these days? Isn't it what it's up there, right?
I think it's actually more competitive than when I applied, which I would like to say not too long ago, but I do feel a bit old now. the nice thing about ENT, yes, there are certain scores with the step exams that you do need to ideally have a minimum for. But I thought the nice thing when I applied to ENT is that the programs, the providers in the field, they look at you as a complete package. They look at you, okay, do you, have the skill set as well as the personality and the drive fit being an ENT provider.
Mm-hmm. Very specific. And so do you frequently run into misconceptions about plastic surgery? I know that I just, read a lot about it and like it's always on the cover of magazines. And I'm sure what you do is very different than what people think.
Right. I think One thing to keep in mind when it comes to plastic surgery, there's both a reconstructive focus and cosmetic focus. I think the reconstructive part was the main thing that drew me to the field of plastic surgery, given my own experiences. And while I do enjoy the cosmetic side and helping patients achieve facial rejuvenation goals, there's something just about whether it's reconstructing a skin cancer defect, helping a patient who's had facial trauma, or a patient with like a cleft lip, cleft palate deformity, a patient with a medical condition. I think it goes a long way. And, you know, myself as a patient when I was a child, I think I can identify with that. I think another potential misconception, and this is, you know, where I'm seeing with my patients, where they're worried about looking unnatural. Particularly when we talk about doing non-surgical procedures in the clinic to achieve facial rejuvenation. A lot of patients say, hey, I don't want to have duck lips. I don't want to look like I have a lot done. I think when we have, for instance, certain celebrities in LA who we look to for, you know, what we define as, you know, most youthful appearances, pushing the edge when it comes to appearance and fashion. Sometimes they, I think, push the boundaries, maybe sometimes a bit too much, and then, you know, make potential patients question, you know, what can be really done or not done to help them achieve their goals.
Totally. Yeah. We see a lot of the results that are maybe most quote unquote extreme as opposed to the stuff you're talking about, the more common.
Right.
So if I were going to meet with you, what would an initial consultation look like?
So for me, it's, you know, usually about a 30 to 45 minute visit. I think other providers have that similar opportunity, because the key thing is I want to, you know, establish trust with the patient from the beginning. You know, it's a big deal. They're trusting their face with me, and I want to make sure I devote enough time and counseling to make sure that I can help address any questions they have, help to talk with them the best treatment options for them to make them feel most comfortable. So right from the get-go, I talk to them about my treatment approach, keeping it natural, keeping it conservative, and how I want patients walking out of my office feeling refreshed, but as if no one knows what we exactly did together. Then I go into asking them about their past medical or surgical history, and basically what their problem areas in their face that they see, and their treatment goals. I then do like a top-down analysis in their face, just to concentrate on the areas that they most are concerned about, but also let them know too objectively, you know, if they haven't thought about it before, maybe potential areas that could benefit from treatment as well. And then after that, I bring it back to, you know, catering it to the individual patient's anatomy, their treatment goals, and even their budget, to then, you know, decide with them what the best treatment options are, what they would like to pursue. It's also important to talk about potential benefits and risks for each type of procedure to make sure that the patient is well-informed and has realistic expectations. If we have enough time, and usually I do accommodate my schedule, say if it's like Botox or filler, we'll get it done same day.
Interesting. I think a lot of people, myself included, would be nervous to go in a consultation from what we've seen on TV, which is like, you know, a plastic surgeon has a marker and they just show that, you know, here's where we'll do this and this, this, and like without asking any questions. So that's right. Important, I think, for listeners to know that a good consultation with a good doctor does not look like that. It's about a conversation and listening.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
And just one extra thing too. A lot of times what helps is I'll have a mirror in the room as well, just so that we're looking at the patient's face together. And then so I can help point out things. And something helpful too that I know a lot of other utilize is if it's a patient who returns to me after treatment, I'll do post-treatment photographs, and then we can go over them together to see what results we've achieved and the changes we see.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So when you're in a typical workday, what are some of the most common concerns women ask about and men ask about?
So as a plastic surgeon, I would say, and I think across other surgeons too, the majority of our patients are female. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to aesthetic concerns, I kind of divide female patients into younger patients versus older patients. So younger patients may come in, they want to be preventative about their wrinkles. So we may be talking about neurotoxin treatments like Botox. They may be interested in a little lip rejuvenation, like seeking more volume or definition to their lips. More recently, I've had patients come in who want to have increased jawline definition. I think mm-hmm. that's an increasingly popular procedure. In my older female patients, we try to tackle areas where we can help with facial rejuvenation overall. So these are the patients that could maybe benefit from multiple procedures, like doing Botox plus the fillers to help improve volume, minimize facial folds, and give a lifting effect. I love doing treatment to the cheeks, for instance, if you can help rejuvenate the mid-face area, that goes a long way. One area that I feel like I address every single day now, and this is amongst younger and older patients, is the dark circle appearance. One factor associated with that is what we call a tear trough deformity, a hollowing in the under eyes that can be improved with filler. This can be seen in young patients who just genetically have it, as well as older patients who, from gravity bringing the tissues down and volume loss, develop this as well. And then real quickly for my male patients, they, you know, may come in and want to seek treatment for their wrinkles, also for helping with facial rejuvenation as well, or increased jawline definition. So sometimes similar needs to my female counterparts, but I always have to keep in mind, you know, that I might have to approach the treatment a little bit differently to help make sure that they're retaining their more masculine features.
Awesome. So I have so many questions about all the procedures you just mentioned. They're so fascinating mm-hmm. to me. For fillers in general, do they dissolve, or do some dissolve and some don't? Like, what happens to them over time?
So the most common type of filler out there is what we call hyaluronic acid filler. I think one of the major companies quotes that over 90% of the fillers injected are hyaluronic acid form. Hyaluronic acid is essentially a molecule that's actually found naturally in our own bodies, in our own skin, and it gives that plumping effect. It's involved in wound healing. So the filler products have a modified form of this. Any filler product that you see that has hyaluronic acid, essentially it will go away with time. It will resorb in your body. The depending on the type of filler, the average duration ranges from about 1 to 2 years. There are permanent fillers out there. I think they're just because we have strict regulations in the U.S. They're more, you know, popular outside of the country, but there are permanent and fillers. And before hyaluronic acid fillers, you know, came to rise in popularity, we did have more, we had permanent options such as silicone in the past too. But permanent fillers definitely have, you know, certain higher risks to be taken into account.
Mm-hmm. And hyaluronic acid, I've seen that in skincare products as a topical treatment or in moisturizer. Is that something that's also effective if you put on top of your skin?
Yes. So again, as I mentioned, it's, you know, naturally a part of our body, or of our bodies and our skin, and it just helps to hydrate and plump the skin. Mm. So it's a great adjunct component to skincare products. I definitely highly recommend it for any patient as part of their anti-aging skin regimen.
Oh, good to know. And for for the lip fillers, which you mentioned, I'm really curious about mm-hmm. those. We've all seen some celebrities that seem like they overdo it, and it just feels like, oh gosh, we're at a point where this doesn't look natural. Is there a way to like get them back to normal, or do you have to wait out for those fillers to dissolve?
So, regardless, if a hyaluronic acid filler is used, it will dissolve over time. So in a way, that could be the safest but longest process to let, you know, a product go away. With these hyaluronic acid fillers, they actually can be reversible with an injection called hyaluronidase. The effect is pretty immediate within hours and takes into full effect within 1 to 2 days. And so say if a patient is really unhappy with their result, especially with the lips, or if they you have like a high risk complication like infection or vascular compromise, the filler can be dissolved fairly quickly. I think when it comes to avoiding unnatural results with lip filler, it's definitely important to see a specialized provider who has experience with lip filler injections, can talk to you about their approach, and even maybe show before and after pictures. Mm-hmm. I feel like a lot of my older patients are really scared when we even talk about lip filler because they keep saying, I don't want to have duck lips. Mm-hmm. So as long as the, you know, provider can reassure, okay, this is my approach, and this is how and where I inject the filler, and you know those photos you see on Instagram, for instance, of the really juicy lips. Mm-hmm. And again, some patients prefer that result. It a lot of times takes incremental treatments, not just one syringe, but multiple syringes, and that boundary can be pushed as long as the injector knows that we just need to take our time and do it amongst a series of treatments rather than try to do it all at once.
Yeah, that's great to know. And great to note, yeah, you can pace it out. You can undo a little bit if you get the right kind. That's great. Right. I also heard, speaking of fillers, this thing about a liquid nose job or a non-permanent nose job. Is that fillers around the nose? How does that work?
So that also is now an extremely popular procedure since I myself trained in rhinoplasty and have seen when filler on the nose has gone bad. I am pretty conservative and prefer not to do what they call a non-surgical rhinoplasty or liquid rhinoplasty. But again, essentially what filler can do for the nose as well as in other areas of the face is to basically help mask, you know, certain deficient areas and to help achieve more proportion or balance. So for instance, you can take a patient with a little bump on the bridge of their nose that they're concerned by and put, for instance, a little filler around it, maybe above and below the bridge to make the bridge look a little more smooth.
Interesting.
You could also apply a little filler maybe at the base of the nose to help make the tip rotated up more if that is what the patient is seeing. But again, it's subtle changes, and overall, that's what filler does to achieve.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Beautiful results. Mm-hmm. I would recommend, though, if you'd like a more permanent solution, if a patient's seeking a more permanent solution and needs more refined change, like say if they want a smaller refined tip to their nose, then surgery is the way to go.
Good to know. Yeah, that's really interesting. I'm seeing a lot about those. I feel like I hadn't heard about them till very recently. Mm-hmm. Speaking of recent, some of my friends are now doing what they call preventative Botox, meaning that they're young and they really don't have wrinkles. And they're mm-hmm. saying that they're doing Botox because if you start before you have wrinkles, it'll prevent them. But my theory is that you'd get them anyway. So I'm curious what your thoughts are on preventative Botox.
So I feel like with Botox or other treatments, like at the end of the day, if I point something out and a patient isn't super bothered by this issue, then I don't push treatment there. Because again, we want to make sure that the patient is satisfied with the results and sees a change. So a lot of times I'll point out wrinkles and they say, well, I'm not bothered. I like my wrinkles. And then we, don't go any further. Mm-hmm. I feel like, so for me, I talk to patients when I think of preventive Botox, I address it more to patients who actually are developing lines. They might not be as deep as my older patients, but not necessarily those who don't even have much movement or any lines yet in a certain area. That way that say if when they raise their forehead or, in between the brows, if they're making some lines, you can do some Botox to relax the muscles. You might not have to do a super strong dose, but it will keep those muscles from making those lines and make the lines more etched over time. I really promote the phrase preventative Botox, or that it's preventative for those younger patients who've already developed etched lines at rest, say in their forehead, say between their eyebrows, such that you want to use the Botox to minimize and even get rid of those lines. And if you keep doing it, it'll keep those lines at bay and from becoming deeper over time.
But is it possible to do that Botox and then maintain facial expressiveness? Like, I think the stereotype with Botox is that you can't even lift your eyebrows or just like you're expressionless. Right. But there's probably some middle ground, right, where you're not completely stiff-faced ultimately.
Right. I totally agree with you. And I think that comes down to the experience and technique of the injector. It's, it's straightforward. It's just a series of quick injections with a mathematical basis, but there's an artistic basis to it as well. Mm-hmm. I agree with you that I feel like trying to preserve as much natural movement as possible is key. But for instance, with the forehead, and if it's a patient who's had a number of Botox treatments who comes in to see me, I do gauge the patient too, because there are patients who say, I'd rather my forehead be completely smooth and I'm okay with sacrificing my brow movement a bit, or compared to some of those who say, I just want the lines minimized and I still want to look natural. For me to help achieve the more natural look, it's mostly conservative treatment to the forehead and to what we call the crow's feet, the lines around the eyes, like lateral to the eyes. With the crow's feet, you still want to have some lines there, because as my mentor taught me in fellowship, if you completely get rid of those lines and when you smile, it starts to look unnatural. Mm-hmm. With the forehead, if the injector treats lightly and higher in the forehead, that will help ensure that the brows are still elevating more. If you increase the dosage of the Botox, you have stronger dose, or you inject closer, like down the forehead, closer to the eyebrow, that's when you're at risk of restricting the eyebrow movement and potentially dropping the brow.
Okay.
For treatment.
And if someone starts Botox, I'm curious if it's something that then they would do forever. Like you don't ever stop doing it if you want to keep the results, right? Because how long does Botox last? I should ask.
So Botox and other neurotoxin treatments last on average 3 months. It could be a little bit less, a little bit more, depending on the patient. And then basically I leave it up to the patient. So yes, if you keep repeating it, then you will keep those lines from developing as much and becoming deeper and etched over time. So my patients, some are very proactive and say, I want to schedule my next appointment in 3 or 4 months and have it on the schedule. Others like to wait until they see that the product has worn off and then call to make their appointment. I think it's one of those things. I myself only have had Botox to my masseter, so I can't identify as much. But I would say once you see a treatment like this that's quick and easy, minimal risk, and has such a nice widespread effect that it can be considered addictive, you know, to keep continuing the treatment. Mm-hmm. I do think it's, you know, if you're willing to invest, I think it's, you know, a good treatment to go for. And for sometimes, for instance, my older patients who come to me and haven't had Botox before and they have those etched lines already, sometimes it's just a lot harder to try to create improvement in the wrinkled areas compared to if we started Botox a little bit sooner.
Oh, good to know. That's interesting. This is jumping ahead a bit because I want to ask you a bunch of questions about skincare, but that touches on something that I think all of us are wondering about all the time, which is what we're supposed to actually do about wrinkles, either preventatively or to treat them, and what's out there for that, because there's a bunch of products on the market and I'm assuming most of them are not right. effective. So I'm wondering what in your expertise you would say right. to that.
Right. So it's funny that I'm a facial plastic surgeon and I am fortunate to work at a dermatology practice where that reinforces my knowledge of the skin and skincare. But I do get asked about skincare questions all the time by my patients. And I felt lucky I was able actually to learn about it in my fellowship and also in a way to improve my own skincare. I'm someone who, you know, before in my training, pretty tomboyish, and mm-hmm. now just with some regular maintenance that's, you know, nothing crazy, I have patients and other people telling me often that my skin looks great. I've never been that kind of person before. So I think what myself, other plastic surgeons and dermatologists would recommend, sun protection is the number one thing to prevent wrinkles and you know, sun damage, aging effects. You want to always have SPF of 35, and you can incorporate that into your daily moisturizer to always have sun protection when you're exposed to the sun. And then stepping up from that, what I learned from fellowship, having a skincare regimen with vitamin A, C, and E is really beneficial. Vitamin A is your retinol, which helps with the cell turnover process to help generate new skin cells. And actually, my dermatologist colleagues, since starting my practice with them, they actually recommend for retinoids, which is a stronger form. And it's, if you know, retin A, mm-hmm. which is for acne. So it's at that level, retinoids to incorporate into your skincare regimen. The one possible, side effect or risk with retinoid or retinols is depending on the dose you're on, it could cause some irritation or redness to your skin. And if so, you just need to back down on the dose. So with a retinoid cream, you could do that every other day. The retinol, which is, again, less strong that I have currently my own skincare, I do it twice a day. Mm-hmm. But again, that's because my skin can tolerate that. Vitamin C, which with a couple other things I'll mention in a little bit, are great adjuncts for your overall facial skincare. Vitamin C helps to even out pigmentation. We talked about hyaluronic acid earlier, and then peptides as well. They are great for as an adjunct into the skincare regimen. I also recommend, in addition to what you put on besides your moisturizer and what you put on your face that includes a retinol or retinoid in the morning and night, to have a good eye cream as well as a good neck cream if you're wanting to invest in an anti-aging skincare regimen. The eyes show the first signs of aging. So a good eye cream that could have like peptides or something that promotes moisturization will help keep the puffiness, the fine lines, the darkness at bay, keep that aging process at the bay. Also, peptides are great for to be concentrated around your lips to help minimize fine lines, the smoker lines, we call it, that develop over time. And then the last point I want to make, I know you asked about, like, there's so many products out there. What I tell patients is the products that you buy at the doctor's office are more expensive, but higher grade. So it depends. I think, you know, if you go to, you know, Sephora or you look online, there's a lot of over-the-counter products. I think you can start with there, especially if your budget is not at the price point of what is sold at a cosmetic doctor's office or a med spa. As long as you feel like the reviews are legitimate, you could try with the over-the-counter products. And then ultimately, you could, if you want to invest a bit more, try the products that are sold at the doctor's offices, and then add on adjunct skin rejuvenation treatments too, to really boost the anti-aging skincare regimen.
Wow. I got to thank you for that, because I'm going to go back and write down everything you just said, because I've spent so many hours, I'm sure so many listeners have, on like Reddit forums and Facebook groups, just trying to make sense of all of the non-expert recommendations. And you just distilled it into such a perfect little package, because trust me, I've spent so much money on things I had to throw away because they did not work.
Okay.
So it was very helpful.
Hopefully I wasn't rambling too much.
Not at all. Yeah, oh my God. Also, people make fun of me, but in LA, since I've moved here, I get so worried about how much sun exposure you get just day to day. So I wear a driving sleeve, and this is my non-surgical endorsement, which is you can buy sleeves that are like compression sleeves for running, and you put them on your arms, so you get less sun and you look insane and people make fun of you. But the joke's going to be on them when my left arm looks awesome when I'm older. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Great. That's awesome. That's really helpful. So going back to plastic surgery, I had a couple more questions about that because there's so many things out there that I'm just like, what is going on? One thing that I really want to ask about is, I know this is not your area of expertise at all, but it's something I'm seeing all the time on Instagram and discussed in, you know, on blogs and everything. And it is the rise of the butt implant. And from what I understand, there's a little implant, or there's, you can get fillers in your butt. And I just, whatever information you have on that, I am fascinated to hear.
Okay. So I can probably talk just a little bit, and we'll just defer to my, you know, plastic surgeon colleagues, those who specialize in body plastic. So again, anyone listening out there, if you're interested, please, you know, make sure for your consultation to see someone who specializes in general plastic surgery, specifically in the body. Essentially, yes, kind of similar to the face, where you can think about non-permanent and permanent options. What I've seen and heard about, a permanent, good permanent option is fat transfer. We do it to the face as well, where you can take fat from elsewhere in the body. Again, this is, I'm not sure if it's similar for when it comes to butt augmentation, but for the face, for instance, we take it from like the thighs or the belly. And then you can actually place the fat into the area that needs to be augmented. It's your own material, which is great, and it's a permanent option. The downsides of fat transfer with any procedure, and I caution this with patients, is that it's unpredictable how much fat lasts. We like to say what lasts at about 6 months, because it needs to survive in the area that it was transferred to. But survives at about 6 months, typically about 50% is what is going to survive. Now, I've also seen colleagues out there, particularly Instagram, where they're doing filler injections, I think particularly with one product, Sculptra. Sculptra is a filler. It's not as immediately volumizing. It does require multiple injections, and it leaves like a more permanent effect, actually, in terms of promoting collagen production. So I think filler is a potential option as well. And then I would like to, think implants is a possibility, but again, I'm just not the expert to talk about what kind of permanent implants are possible for butt augmentation.
Gotcha. So with fat transfer, I'm so fascinated by that too, because from just like looking at your body, the quality of fat on your thigh feels and looks to a layperson very different than the fat on your face. So if you put, you know, fat from your thigh somewhere else, does it look like the fat would naturally on in your cheek?
I think it would be fairly similar. Mm-hmm. So the process, how we do it to harvest the fat, it's essentially liposuction. So you basically use a wand and you you place it underneath the skin and you fan this wand back and forth, let's say up in your belly or in your thigh. And then the system I usually work with has like a vacuum, like a negative pressure system, to then collect the fat, which looks like a liquid, like a fatty liquid. Once you feel like you've gotten enough volume, we then spin down the fat so that it all gets concentrated into these syringes. So it's essentially like this, I don't know how to describe it, like this thick fluid. Not similar consistency to filler, but fillers themselves are like a thick cohesive fluid. But it's essentially a fluid that you then inject back into the face.
Mm, that's crazy. I love it. I want that one. it's so funny. It's like you're saying that the fat doesn't last as long on your, in your face or, you know, in other parts of your body. It's like, well, if you can't get rid of the fat on your thighs. So you also mentioned earlier jaw fillers, and I feel like I didn't hear about that for a while. Maybe they were happening. I didn't know about it, but I hear a lot about that, and like the plastic surgery accounts on Instagram I follow talk about them. So how does that work?
So depending on the patient's treatment goals, filler, again, especially if you use certain kind of filler products that have more viscosity and are volumizing, they can help create more definition along the jawline. I do often perform chin augmentation with filler. And these are patients, if you kind of look on their side view, where they are maybe born with a chin that was more recessed, more under projected. And if you increase the projection of the chin with some filler, you can make the face look more proportionate. This is especially in the case with a patient who might be bothered by their nose. If they happen to have a weak chin, as well a chin that's under projected, if you improve the chin projection, then the nose won't appear as big. Which I find really interesting. For patients, a lot of my older female patients, as I mentioned earlier, gravity with aging pulls all the soft tissues down. So that means that your jawline becomes ill-defined. And a lot of older patients have what we call jowling, where you have, you know, that dependent tissue that kind of hangs down from the jaw. And hides it. In front of this area of sagging tissue, you can have what we call like a depression, like because the tissue behind it is more lax. We call it like a pre-jowl sulcus. And it can make the chin, from looking at a person straight on, look more pointed, like a witch's chin, which is a sign of aging. So you can take filler to inject it along the sides of the chin in the front of the jawline to help give a smoother and more defined contour that will make the areas of jowling less obvious to the observer's eye, to give a more youthful appearance and make the chin appear less pointed as well. Mm. And I caution patients, again, this does not definitively address the actual issue, the jowling, which a surgical procedure like a facelift would, to bring back that skin, but it helps to mask it a bit better and restore a more youthful appearance. And then depending, it's actually both younger and older patients have been seeking treatments for defining their jawline, particularly more in the back by the angle of the jaw in front of the ear. You can easily, if you would go on Instagram or other social media, this, I think, especially on amongst younger patients, that they want that more angled look. And this is also a popular treatment amongst male patients to get more jawline definition. I wouldn't necessarily say this is as if to achieve more youthful appearance. It's more of a patient preference if they want to have a more defined appearance to their facial features.
Interesting. All of this is so fascinating because I'm sure, like other listeners out there, my main perception of plastic surgery, especially facial plastic surgery, was like rhinoplasty and facelift and, you know, an eye lift. And it sounds like there's just so many ways out there where a skilled plastic surgeon can administer fillers. And it's just much more creative than I would have thought of, like balancing things and making, if something looks big, making something else look smaller, or all the ways that your face, you know, the parts of it work together is so fascinating. Right. It's really, really interesting.
Right.
So moving on to skincare, because you said that you have expertise in this, and this is such a rich topic. So what are the most common concerns people bring to you about their skin specifically?
So in my older patients, it's basically wrinkling and sun damage are some of their top concerns. If it's wrinkles with facial movement, particularly in the upper third of the face, then we definitely can improve those areas with Botox. I do caution those patients that if they're wrinkle lines are pretty deep or etched at baseline, Botox will only have a certain effect, and that we need to consider adjunct skin rejuvenation treatments too to help further improve the texture, the lines in the skin. And then in terms of other sun damage changes that my older patients are bothered about, it could be brown spots, hyperpigmentation, just crepey appearance to their skin, especially in the lower eyelid area, as well as just skin laxity in general, whether it's now that they have a more ill-defined jawline or they have skin laxity in the neck area. For my younger patients, it depends. If they have like a true dermatologic condition, usually one of my dermatology colleagues get involved. But definitely from a cosmetic standpoint, I have patients talk to me about their scars, particularly deep acne scars, as well as little blood vessels, hyperpigmentation that they want to further address. I also see a number of younger and older patients who want, say, like a benign skin lesion, like a mole or a cyst removed. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy to help them with that.
I've read so many forums about acne scars and how to get rid of them. And it does seem like you got to go to a doctor to really get it done.
Right. I think, and again, my dermatologist colleagues can comment more, but it's first controlling the medical disease. So options like Retin-A, spironolactone, and then once it's well controlled, then you talk about what skin rejuvenation treatments you can do for acne scarring. I know lasers can help. I know types of microneedling can help. We have a procedure called Infini that incorporates microneedling and a radio frequency to really improve acne scars. And then actually something I learned in my practice is that for the deeper acne scars, if they've kind of gone through a number of series of procedures, haven't gotten as much improvement they want, and they still have deep acne scars, filler is a possible treatment to help acne scars.
Interesting. So you also mentioned very commonly something you see is people not wearing enough sunblock, or that should just be one of the main rules of skincare and your face is to wear sunblock and sun protection. Are there other mm-hmm. common practices you see people getting wrong where you're like, ugh, I wish everyone would just either stop doing this or start doing this one thing?
That's a good question. I think... not necessary. I think a lot of times when patients ask me, especially if they're a little bit younger and have signs of aging, of, you know, anything I could have done to prevent this, or, you know, why do I have this issue, especially the dark circle appearance to the eyes? I think a lot of it is just genetics mm-hmm. or what you're born with, you know, especially what you see in your parents, you know, and that you can then gauge or anticipate some of the signs of aging that you may inherit from them from time to time. Mm-hmm. Maybe come back to me with that question. I don't think otherwise there's anything that other than just certain misconceptions about treatments, what they do. For instance, I might have a patient who thinks they need Botox for helping deep lines in the lower part of the face. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, it's really for the forehead. Have you ever seen Botox, though? What is it, like jaw relaxation or something like that? I think there's a celebrity I heard talk about that. I don't know if that's real.
It is. Oh, so it is. That's okay. The only area that I actually received Botox treatment for, mm-hmm. and it really helps. Mm-hmm. So I have a lot of like jaw clenching stress. I grind my teeth from what we call like TMJ dysfunction. And what goes along with it is you have these muscles called the masseters. They're by your jawline, kind of towards the back of your face. And especially in my case, they're what we call hypertrophic, like really big, and they're really strong. So if you actually inject Botox into this muscle, it can weaken the muscle and help relieve the stress that you are causing with the jaw clenching and the grinding of the teeth. However, it doesn't directly address the issue, the TMJ dysfunction. So again, I don't want to speak for dentists out there, but again, I still wear my night guard. And if you have real issues with the temporomandibular joint, such as like your jaw is really clicking and moving out of the joint, then you might actually need certain dental procedures to address the issue at hand. But yes, it really helps me, you know, just to relieve the stress of the force that I create with my muscle by weakening it a bit. And then depending on the patient, if you weaken and essentially make these muscles smaller with Botox, it can help to narrow the lower third of the face. Wow. We think of the ideal youthful face as one that has an inverted pyramid shape with a tapered lower face. So certain patients with more rounded face or of particular ethnicities, for instance, I have Asian patients that come to me that want injection to their master so that their face looks less rounded, that they have a more tapered appearance to the lower face.
Interesting. I'd be interested to talk with plastic surgeons in different countries and like hear what their specific, you know, cultural beauty ideals and all that and ideas about aging, of how they affect the plastic surgery there. That just made me wonder. That's all truly fascinating. So I feel like I've learned a lot. I have to definitely go back and take notes on everything and change literally everything I do always. But for people listening, I feel like I want to give them some takeaways because there's so much here and it's such a gift to have you on. So in general, what advice would you give to people considering plastic surgery?
I think it's important to do your research, to find a provider who has the right credentials, who, especially if it's a general plastic surgeon, that they're board certified. I think this is an issue. I remember, I think it was one of the plastic surgery journals that did a research article and quoted maybe only as little as 20% or less of cosmetic doctors out there on social media are actually board certified.
Whoa.
So I think, again, I probably have to go back and look for that article, but it's a very low number. So
interesting.
I've heard too, I think a big step in, you know, California, like a big deal, is that only board certified plastic or cosmetic surgeons can actually advertise, you know, or state that they're for their reputation, that mm-hmm. they're a plastic surgeon, which I think is a big deal for those who are trained in the field. So yes, do your research. You know, again, I always say, I think because medicine now is so much more consumer and review driven. So definitely take reviews with a grain of salt, but I think it's good to find a surgeon or a provider who has a good amount of positive reviews. I think it's good if they have before and after photos to show you. And then at the end of the day, once you go into that consultation and to talk about your treatment goals, it's really important that you feel like you have trust and confidence in that provider and that you're on the same page when it comes to treatment goals and realistic expectations.
Good to know. These are great. Yeah. And if people are interested, which I'm sure they are, in learning more about your practice or connecting with you, how can people find you, and what advice would you give them about getting in touch?
Sure. So again, I'm Dr. Tina Ho. I'm a facial plastic surgeon in the Philadelphia area. My website is www.drtinaho.com. I also have a professional and personal Instagram account that you're happy to follow at drtinaho, Dr. Tina Ho. Again, I'm someone also who's happy to answer questions. I think one great resource is RealSelf. It connects consumers who are potential patients to providers, and providers themselves can have their own pages where they show their reviews, before and after pictures, answer questions. So I think that's
great.
Pretty much it.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so, so much for taking the time to chat about this. This was the best hour of my life.
And no worries. Yeah, thanks for having me.
I really appreciate it. Yeah, great. Okay, so everyone follow Dr. Tina. And wow, we got a lot of work to do. Thank you.
Forever Dog.
This has been a Forever Dog production. Executive produced by Brett Boehm, Joe Cilio, and Alex Ramsey. For more original podcasts, please visit foreverdogpodcasts.com and subscribe to our shows on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Keep up with the latest Forever Dog news by following us on Twitter and Instagram @ForeverDogTeam and liking our page on Facebook.